2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's quota acts of piracy cost them millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it is leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued a policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's army kicked off a maneuver that put to test hundreds of its domestically built unmanned aerial vehicles. The two-day military exercises saw the use of a variety of surveillance and reconnaissance drones, combat drones, bombers, and loitering munitions, which are known as suicide drones. As part of the drill, the Persian Gulf was simulated as the conflict zone, where the Iranian Army's Navy used the suicide drones to destroy their targets.
All of the four forces of the army took part in the drills by deploying their drones. Each force concentrated on their assigned missions. We at the Navy used a variety of our stealth drones that can fly deep into the enemy's waters and keep a close eye on their activities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's defense industry has been hit by U.S. arms embargoes for four decades. The sanctions have barred Iran from purchasing any foreign weapons, even from its closest allies. However, Iranian officials say the country's defense sector is up and running. The reason is the country has for all these years been developing its own arms based on domestic capabilities. And now, drones are the epitome of Iran's advances in the defense industry.
In the field of UAVs, Iran is neck and neck with the few countries that have the technology. We began by producing surveillance UAVs, but today, our unmanned aircraft can conduct combat missions as well. And we owe this achievement to US sanctions, because they forced us to rely on our domestic resources.
The Islamic Republic stepped into the field of UAV production around 2011 by reverse engineering American and Israeli drones it electronically commandeered or shot down. Tehran says today it is self-sufficient in designing, producing, and operating a range of UAVs with different applications.
In less than a decade, the term UAV grew from an alien word to a keyword in Iran's airspace. Still, the Iranian army says this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the greater part of Iran's defense capabilities is yet to be publicized.
The Prime Minister made the announcement Monday. The country will be going back to its 2020 mantra, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Boris Johnson warned there were going to be tough weeks ahead, but still offered a ray of hope.
The weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. But I really do believe that we're entering the last phase of the struggle, because with every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people. And thanks to the miracle of science, not only is the end in sight, but we know exactly how we will get there.
Some children across England had one day in school before the announcement was made, and people are vexed by yet another last-minute announcement. The opposition says the government is going to make mistakes, but to make the same mistakes again is unacceptable. But Boris Johnson insists the tier system was working and that the new variant of COVID-19 is what derailed it. The Prime Minister's remarks caused hashtags resign, school closures, and Boris has failed the UK to shoot to the top of the country's Twitter trending charts. He is accused of ignoring the science by insisting schools are safe. The third lockdown will be hard for families juggling work and school, but many companies in the leisure, retail and hospitality sectors feel they might not make it through to the spring. In response to these fears, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made an announcement Tuesday.
Well, in order to help support businesses through a difficult period through to the spring, today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help. For businesses in the most affected sectors who are asked to close, they will receive up to £9,000 in a one-off cash grant. It's important to remember that comes on top of the existing monthly grant of £3,000 that those businesses receive and the extension of furlough all the way through to April. You know, we remain committed to protecting jobs and supporting businesses.
The new COVID-19 restrictions come days after the UK and the EU reached a trade and security agreement as part of their Brexit divorce deal, and businesses in Britain had to start trading differently. They were dreading this, but now they say planning around COVID-19 restrictions has made the extra paperwork surrounding post-Brexit trade pale into insignificance. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients. Charitable groups have warned, in a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
E quindi diventa sempre più difficile.
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Alcuni magari avendo perso il lavoro.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times. Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived, when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barista ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
The situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US and internationally. Because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
It's very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. He is also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against the Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing, trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, deputy head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kano.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Debate. Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Finally, Congress has certified the U.S. president-elect's Electoral College victory, ending the plethora of the outgoing president's lawsuits. Now, this hours after a pro-Trump supporters stormed the Capitol Wednesday, four people died, many more got injured, and nearly 70 others got arrested. President Trump now saying he's committed to an orderly transition of power. Tons of condemnations pouring in from big names around the world, including from former U.S. presidents and U.S.'s European allies. Iran's President Rouhani is also regarded as an indication of the vulnerability and failure of Western democracy. Now let's start the debate show. Let's first go to Washington, D.C., to our own correspondent there, Colin Campbell. Colin, tell about some of those reactions and give us some more details regarding this.
We have four sitting U.S. presidents who have condemned what happened on Capitol Hill on Wednesday afternoon when you had rioters and looters maraud through the halls of Congress. You had President Barack Obama making probably in the sharpest terms, talking about how the current president, Donald Trump, incited some of that violence that occurred and resulted in the deaths of four people on Wednesday. And then, of course, you had the last sitting Republican president, George W. Bush, also condemning what happened and just said that what occurred was more reminiscent of a banana republic and not a democratic republic like we like to consider the United States. At the same time, we're receiving criticism from leaders all over the world, including those from France and the UK, like Boris Johnson, saying that there should be a more peaceful transfer of power. We have heard from the current president, Donald Trump, who did release a statement after the deaths yesterday of four people and dozens of injuries, saying that there would be a peaceful transfer of power on January 20th. Some people are saying that that should be taken with a grain of salt, considering the president does not always tell the truth and is not very straightforward most times with several different things. So we're waiting to see just days away how this is all going to go, especially now that the votes from the Electoral College have been confirmed by the president's vice president, Michael Pence.
Okay, thank you for that. Dr. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now let me invite author and commentator David Swanson from Charlottesville, Virginia. Good to have you with us. First question for you is, let's talk about the factors culminating in what happened on Capitol Hill. Washington caused similar moves in other countries, let's say Venezuela and Serbia, for instance. Now it's experiencing it on home turf. Have the chickens come home to roost?
Yeah, that comment about banana republics, well, we know what causes coups in banana republics. This was that rare thing, a coup in a country without a U.S. embassy, right? It was also that rare thing, an attack on the U.S. government without a war in response to it, because it was an attack by people from the U.S. Can you imagine if a group of Iranian tourists or Russian or Asian tourists from anywhere in Asia had attacked the U.S. Capitol? Human life on Earth might be gone by now. So there are different responses depending on the actors. And this, of course, ironically, was on the same day that President-elect Joe Biden named Victoria Nuland as a possible nominee for Undersecretary of State, a principal organizer of a coup in Ukraine, advocate of a coup in Russia, etc. So this was the result of Congress looking at a president who instigated hateful violence against immigrants, against blacks, against women, against media, against leftists for 4 years, and saying, well, we won't do anything because we're not immigrants, we're not blacks, we're not women. And now, finally, within hours, you have dozens and dozens of Congress members wanting impeachment, which others of us have been demanding for over 4 years. You also had a very biased response by the police on Capitol Hill. If those had been peace activists or leftists with peaceful posters and signs, the police would have attacked them, not waited until they got inside the building to break out the tear gas. I mean, this was like Iraq 03, where if you're attacking anything other than the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, it's okay, go right ahead. So I think people are starting to see the bias in a supposedly fair and equal system.
Okay, now, let me, from Washington, D.C., invite former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kerouac. John, good to have you with us. Let me ask you about the storming of the Capitol Hill. What does it say about the underlying deficit of democracy in the United States?
Well, frankly, I think democracy in the United States is showing cracks. This is the danger of populism. We saw this danger not just yesterday, but over the last 4 years, where people are repeating the president's assertions, for example, that the media are the enemy of the people, that progressives, liberals, blacks, and other minorities don't have a place in American politics, that the right is oppressed and needs to take to the streets. This is 4 years of danger just building and building, and it finally culminated yesterday in what really was, in my view, a coup attempt, and at the very least, insurrection.
Right. David, we have this YouGov report, and it says 45% of Republicans and one in five voters have backed the attack on Capitol Hill. Is this not a sign of a big division?
It is a sign of a huge division, and there was a big crowd in Washington, D.C. on the side of this coup or insurrection beyond those who took part at the Capitol building. And this is an indication of the power of the media and the idiocy of the president-elect demanding that Trump be put on television. Putting Trump on television created this crisis. We need the media outlets like Twitter to ban Trump from speaking ever again. But this is a development that comes out of decades of division, of divisive policies, of the absence of universal benefits coming from the U.S. government, a divisive, racist society where there is inequality growing, suffering growing, declining quality of life to the point where the U.S. can't be compared to most wealthy countries, has to be compared to third world countries, and people are angry. And until those on the left deliver them something, there are people who are going to turn to the right.
Now, John, we also have Ted Cruz saying that 36% of Americans see eye to eye with President Trump when it comes to complaining about vote rigging. They say there has been some fraud. So what's this supposed to indicate in a country that's always boasting of human rights and democracy?
Right. There is literally no evidence whatsoever that there was voter fraud in any of the states, whether they were close in the presidential election or not. This speech that Ted Cruz gave on the floor of the Senate last night is going to be his legacy. The sad truth is that that 36% figure is likely correct. But there's always going to be a core of people who will believe Donald Trump no matter what he says. If he says the moon is made out of cheese, they'll believe that the moon is made out of cheese. And this is the danger of a president who keeps repeating a lie over and over and over again, because eventually a good solid core of Americans will believe that lie.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you think about this saying?
That was John.
David.
Well, I think there is a chance that to a significant degree, Trump will fall out of favor, even among many Republicans, not because he's a lawless demagogue, not because he's a criminal bigot, but because he cost them the state of Georgia and the majority in the U.S. Senate. There will, as John rightly says, always be people who will never Trump. And this is a reason to immediately reconvene the Congress, impeach him, and remove him, or build the pressure to use the 25th Amendment or compel his resignation, because he will continue this. He will pardon those involved. He will run for office again if he's not barred from running for office again, which is a penalty that can be imposed through impeachment and conviction, even when someone is already out of office. And people to the liberal side of things will begin to see the military as the solution. I can't tell you how many people left of center yesterday were cheering for the National Guard, were cheering for the shooting of a woman in the U.S. Capitol, because they were on the Republican side rather than the Democratic side. So unless Congress acts and acts nonviolently through the rule of law, increasingly, people on both sides of politics in the U.S. are going to see force and militarism as the solution. And this is a danger that extends beyond Trumpism.
Okay, John, let me now read part of a tweet by veteran U.S. diplomat Richard Haass. The tweet goes, "So much for the peaceful transfer of power. We already knew what we need to know about this president. The question is, how do we get to where so many Americans are so willing to throw democracy overboard?" Your take on that, please.
Richard Haass is one of the most experienced former diplomats that we have in think tanks. He's the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so he's seen presidents come and go. And like the rest of us, I think he's never seen a president like this one. What he's saying is exactly right. And what David said a moment ago is exactly right. We've had 4 years of this demagogue, out of control demagogue. We need to bring sanity back to our policy. And I'm not saying that Joe Biden necessarily is, you know, the perfect president-elect to bring sanity back. He's certainly a neoliberal and has supported wars all over the world. But I think so many Americans have come to the conclusion that anybody is better than Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. David, one basic question, and what caused all this to happen? I mean, pushing half Americans to vote for somebody like Trump, you know, with all of his personal attributes that you know better. Because this could stay and this could go on and it could still threaten the United States in different ways.
I think unless we get something dramatically better than what can be expected of Joe Biden left to his own devices, we will have a return of Trump or Trumpism in a different guise or something worse. Until the left or the center in U.S. politics delivers people health care and retirement and job prospects and a peaceful, prosperous, sustainable society with a good outlook for their children, stops coming in last in handling disease pandemics, stops coming in first in brutal imprisonment and incarceration, stops coming in last in retirement and security and sense of well-being, then you're going to have people resorting to this sort of demagogue who promises them that the whole problem is some other group and what's needed is to bash them, and at least it'll make you feel good even if you're still sick and hungry. And so it's not enough to get anybody other than Trump. Anybody other than Trump on its own is going to bring us back Trump. And unless Trump, as I said, is barred from running for office again, he himself is likely to run for office again.
Mm-hmm. And John, this Trumpism, this ideology is staying there. It's not only Trump, it could be manifested in somebody else. Let's see what the root causes have been.
Yeah, I think the root causes are angry white men really believe that they're being discriminated against. It's the craziest thing. They really believe that policies enacted over the last decades favor minorities, and they believe that Christianity is being squelched across the United States. To many observers, including me, it's so preposterous as to be laughable. But they really do believe this. And to pick up on a point that David made a moment ago, Trumpism without Donald Trump is alive and well. There is a possibility, a good possibility, that Donald Trump will run for president again. But we're already seeing people like Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who are emulating Donald Trump in their speeches now in order to appeal to his base of support so that when they run for president in 4 years, and I'm sure all three of them will, they're going to sound just like Donald Trump.
Right. And David, basically, why should there be this bipartisan thing, you know, should be this domineering across the whole U.S. politics, no third party, you know, got any chance of, you know, getting any serious votes? What's wrong with this? Why the duopoly?
Well, I think that is a major part of the problem, especially in combination with even bigger parts of the problem, including the legalized system of bribery, of what are called bribes in other countries, but campaign contributions in the United States system, combined with the media problem. You have a corrupt, quasi-state corporate media system that shuts out alternatives. So it's not just the winner-take-all system, which, yes, could be reformed into a proportional or parliamentarian system, but it's that problem compounded many-fold by the financial corruption, by the media control, by the domination of the media and the ballots and the system by these two parties, not by the government, but by those two parties together. We need major reforms to the system if we're going to get something we could call representative, much less democratic.
Now, John, what do you think? Why shouldn't any independents or third parties have anything to say in the elections?
You know, I think we are in dire need of viable third parties. I have voted third party in the last two elections, and, the duopoly that we have, it just simply doesn't work anymore. We need a progressive party. Maybe non-Trump moderate Republicans need some sort of right-of-center party. And what we have now, the Greens and the Libertarians, are being officially oppressed in the respect that they're not allowed to automatically appear on ballots in all 50 states. They have a very difficult time raising money. They're not invited to debates, which means their ideas are never heard. That's got to change if there's going to be real movement on Capitol Hill, if there's going to be a real desire among the American people to try to clean up this system. It's clearly broken.
Now, David, Moscow has reacted to this Capitol incident. It blames what it calls the archaic electoral process in the U.S., which is not democratic. The question is, why shouldn't popular votes decide election results?
Well, historically, because the states want power as entities rather than just human beings. I think weighing the pros and cons, we would be better off with human beings having all of the power in this instance rather than the states. And there are a number of states and organizations and activists making huge progress in that direction, likely to succeed in the relatively near future, either by getting enough states to commit to honoring the national popular vote, the whoever wins the most nationally wins, or by enough states deciding on their own, as they are perfectly free to do and always have been, to distribute their electoral college votes proportionally, not giving them all to the single person who gets the majority or even just the plurality in that state. There are currently two states that do it that way. The other 48 are free to start doing it that way tomorrow. And we just have to build enough public pressure in that direction.
All right. John, what do you think about that? Popular vote or electoral college?
I think popular vote is the only way that we can have real democracy. The electoral college is a holdover from the 18th century and the 19th century. It was meant to ensure states' rights. It was meant to ensure the power and authority of landowners. It's antiquated. We really have to change it.
Well, David, can this be mended? I mean, this the system we were talking about when we were finding faults with it, what can be done about it?
Well, all kinds of things can be reformed. We can clean the money out. We can effectively or literally get rid of the Electoral College. We can create publicly funded media. We can support useful popular media. We can become better, wiser consumers and producers of media and communications. We can pressure Congress members and presidents and officials quite apart from elections. I mean, we've had success in already defeating a couple of the worst nominees for cabinet positions in the upcoming government without any elections playing any role in that whatsoever. But, you know, Biden, as of yesterday, has lost the Senate excuse. He was going to be able to say, I'm powerless to do anything good or change anything dramatically because of the Senate. That excuse is gone. So now, immediately, any big reforms that we want that we don't get, we can blame on the Democratic Party, which has complete power in the legislative and executive branches. So if we don't get decent wages and decent health care and an end to wars and a restoration of the Iran agreement and some movement on abolishing sanctions and a better approach on coronavirus and on, there's no big excuse available anymore.
Right.
So now's the time to make these demands.
Okay, John, we have 30 seconds for your final comments.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we also really need public financing of presidential campaigns. The big corporations are the ones that control the political process, and the oligarchs in the United States. That has to change.
Okay. And on that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests who joined us with our comments. We had former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kerouac from Washington, D.C., and author and commentator David Swanson from Charlottesville, Virginia. See you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the 8-year war and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon the role of national cooperation and empathy during the 8 years of war, which resulted in the frustration of the enemies and victory of the Iranian people. Stay tuned, please. When the Iranian people, alongside military forces, entered the battlefield, the armed forces gained a stronger morale for fighting and repelling the aggressive enemy. The armed forces trusted the people and vice versa. This trust turned into a real belief and played a very significant role in the final triumph of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the imposed war. As the Basij volunteer forces participated in the war, people from all walks of life and from various occupations felt their responsibility to take part in the war. Most of the Basij forces were young people from different specialties. Thus, the war theater was the arena for manifestation of different talents. In view of this, from among these volunteer forces, great commanders emerged like martyr Hassan Bagheri, who had gone to the front as a journalist but turned into a genius in combat operations. Many of the scientific and technological Gordian knots of the war were opened by these very popular forces. Presently too, Iran owes many of its great achievements and progresses to these people. If we look at the war from this aspect, we should say that many of the senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the army who played a determining role in the war were trained in the cultural ground of the Holy Defense. Although over 250,000 of the best youth of Iran were martyred in the war, the future of the country has been guaranteed by these very motivated people. The participation of Basiji forces in the administration of cities and villages during the war solved many problems for the government. In fact, the Basij organization entered the arena of problems and made its utmost effort to remove obstacles on the way of government and the people. The most outstanding feature of the Basij has always been its self-sacrifice and readiness for working whenever need arises. The Basij forces didn't wait to become strong to fight. They fought to become strong. The manpower that emerged in the war firmly believed in Imam Khomeini's famous phrase, "We can." The Iranian combatants created such values during the war that have rarely been seen in the wars in the world. They would compete for doing the hardest jobs. The Basij forces, especially the youth, had fought with their carnal and mean desires first. The battlefronts were the places of self-building and moral expurgation. The combatants would never backbite or tell a lie. They refrained from having grudges against each other. They would never calumniate one another. They would avoid show-off. That is, they would do everything for God's sake and not for becoming famous or being praised by others. The higher a combatant was in military rank, the humbler he would become. In view of this, many times the commanders would wake up at night to polish the boots of their forces or wash their clothes while they were asleep. The battlefronts were the places of spirituality and hope in God. When one or some of the fellow combatants were martyred, others would try to keep the morale of the forces high and fresh. There were innumerable cultural values in the 8-year holy defense. The war caused the spirit of not fearing of death prevail among people. Many people could see manifestation of the ayahs of the Noble Quran. They could see that the blood of martyrs was enlivening and each martyr could revive dead souls among people to continue his path. Martyrdom seeking and self-sacrifice had become the prevalent culture of the majority of the people. People highly esteemed their combatants, and martyrdom was considered as an eternal dignity. People really believed in the Quranic ayah, which reads, "And do not suppose those who have been killed in the way of Allah as dead. Rather, they are living, receiving sustenance with their Lord." According to Imam Khomeini, this ayah does not point to the life after this world, as all creatures will have some sort of life in the other world. Rather, it says that martyrs enjoy living with their Lord and enter Allah's banquet. In short, the Holy Defense was a unique period in which all divine values and moralities materialized and were palpably present in the society.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.